Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello, I'm Stuart McFarlane, and during this programme, I'll be talking to some of the many people involved in the creation of the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry. This arts project, one of the biggest of its kind anywhere in the world, has so far produced 305 carefully stitched panels, each with its own distinct connection to Scotland. All the embroidered panels are rich in colour and texture. It's the stitched tapestry rather than a woven one. The stitchers from all around the world worked in groups, spending hundreds of hours carefully bringing their chosen stories to life. Each panel tells its own unique story. It's very much a people's story. From pioneers and inventors to poets and those who worked the land, creating a new, richer landscape for themselves and the people around them, the tapestry and all the stories within is by design very welcoming. As well as project organisers, you'll also hear from stitchers and historians who have documented many of the journeys made by Scots who've left home for a new life abroad. You're listening to Lasting Impression, the story of the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry.
The story, the saga, is epic. Rather than indulge in what you would call the Burns Supper School of Scottish history by saying that, you know, it's because of the Scottish character that these people succeeded, in my view at least, it was not because of that. It was because of the particular formation of the emigrant group. The myth that they were all poor Highland crofters and the deprived of the slums is entirely inaccurate, at least for the second half of the 19th and into the 20th century.
It released enormous energy in those communities we went to ask them what their story was. What's the story? Would you like to stitch it? And they were all saying yes.
In 1900, Scotland was the second richest nation on the planet, but yet it had emigration levels of the same as poor countries like Ireland, Norway. Because, therefore, Scotland's economy was so advanced, and because Scotland's emigration was aspirational, the result was that they did punch above their weight in the countries they settled.
Well, one of the reasons why the Scots were such brilliant plant collectors and gardeners and employed all over Europe as gardeners was they had the work ethic of the working class background, but they had the education that they could read the Latin names of the plants and study them.
The amount of information that's in that diaspora tapestry is absolutely massive. And there's lots of really small details in it, and there's lots of humour as well. But the amount of information and the sense of pride that all these different communities are expressing about their link with Scotland is a huge responsibility.
For centuries, Scots have migrated all over the world and have often had a profound impact on the areas where they've settled. Their stories and experiences have been documented in many different ways over the years, from journals and diaries to photographs and letters posted home to family members. A few have had their stories told more publicly through newspaper articles, history textbooks and even films. Over the past 3 years, the creation of the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry has provided communities around the globe with the chance to identify people of Scots descent who have made a special contribution to their community. This project has seen over 30 communities documenting their Scottish connections and ancestry on a series of embroidered panels. Their combined stories pay homage to the incredible determination and courage of Scots over the centuries. So when did Scots begin to leave their homeland? Where did they settle? And what made them leave in the first place? Prominent academic Sir Tom Devine has studied the subject for many years.
The story, the saga, is epic. We used to think that Scottish emigration was, you know, mainly limited to the obvious places, England, Canada, the USA, Australasia, South Africa. And that's indeed where the bulk emigration took place. But what we neglected to take into account were the relatively small numbers, but nevertheless having huge impact, of people like physicians, engineers, educators, and above all merchants, who also moved into China South America, parts of Africa outside South Africa, which had, you know, was part of the British Empire, and Southeast Asia. The Scots became a global people, and not very many immigrations or that kind of thing behaved like that. And that's why I think we can actually attach the word diaspora in its original Greek root, which means scattering. Sometimes diaspora is used essentially, or used to be used essentially, of the Jewish forced emigration. That's its original, in a sense, meaning. But I've gone back to the original Greek root to mean scattering across long distances and over time. And if you take into account also the fact that Scots were leaving Scotland in significant numbers from the 13th century without a gap down to the mid-1990s, it's literally only the last few years that we've had a slight surplus above emigration due to a slight reduction in emigration, an increase in the birth rate, and, interestingly enough, inward migration. 80,000 Poles, first generation, now live in Scotland in the year 2011. And at the last, not the last census, but the last census which has been analysed, 406,000 first generation English people, Scotland's biggest immigrant group of today. So over that literally seven centuries, we've been hemorrhaging people. When bad times come, often people start to vote with their feet. Mm. Scottish emigration, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries, was distinctive in the sense that in 1900, Scotland was the second richest nation on the planet, but yet it had emigration levels of the same as poor countries like Ireland, Norway, southern Spain, southern Italy, and central regions of Europe. Because, therefore, Scotland's economy was so advanced, and because Scotland's emigration was aspirational, the people who tended to leave, especially the males, were semi-skilled, skilled, and there was even a small minority of professionals who had been to university. The result was that they did punch above their weight in the countries they settled, not because they were genetically Scottish, but because they had the edge in technical skill and the fact that they were not being forced out. Clearance in the Highlands is only an operative factor up until the early 1850s. It cannot explain what happened from the mid-19th century down to the present day. And therefore, because you had a Scottish emigration which in social background was slightly above the norm for Europe, they also spoke English. They were Protestant in the main. Many of them were skilled or semi-skilled. And so it's almost like Scottish emigration is almost like a kind of technology transfer to the new world.
South America is not as associated with the Scottish diaspora as perhaps more traditional places like the United States of America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand and South Africa. But there is a strong link that goes right back to the discovery of Latin America by the Spaniards and Portuguese. Central and South America have only ever had a handful of English-speaking colonies or territories, such as British Honduras, British Guyana and the Falkland Islands. Scots have been active in all of these places and in the Caribbean in particular. But it was in the larger countries in South America, the likes of Argentina, Brazil and Chile, that they really made their mark.
The New World, including places that you've just mentioned, Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, but also, of course, the USA, Canada and Australasia, had an enormous amounts of virgin land and natural resources. They even had cheap labour because they were pouring in from Central Europe and from China. Mm-hmm. But what these countries lacked was skilled labour, mm-hmm, and semi-skilled labour, mm-hmm, and especially at the very highest level, people who could fill administrative posts. And that's what this country produced. And that's the reason why in almost all areas where they settled, there's an awareness of the fact of the Scottish variable, the Scottish impact on their development as countries. Half the institutions of higher education in Canada were indirectly or directly founded by Scots. Rather than indulge in what you would call the Burns Supper School of Scottish history by saying that, you know, it's because of the Scottish character, mm-hmm, that these people succeeded, in my view at least, It was not because of that. It was because of the particular formation of the immigrant group. The myth that they were all poor Highland crofters and the deprived of the slums is entirely inaccurate, at least for the second half of the 19th and into the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And of course, given the fact that these people were coming from that background, they were always on the make. Greed was one of the defining Scottish characteristics. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the darker side of Scottish emigration, expropriation of native peoples, heavy involvement in the slave economies of the tobacco country in North America and the Caribbean, and perhaps above all, the fact that this country has spawned, or did spawn, the world's most important drug traders of all time, Jardine, Matheson and Company, who debauched the Chinese nation in the mid-19th century, or at least the Chinese elites in the 19th century, making China almost ungovernable by huge importation of opium from India. The Mexicans and the Colombians mm-hmm. of the 19th century.
It's pretty clear that Scots have made quite the impression when they've moved around the globe. They've certainly made a real impact in many countries around the world. But how do you go about telling the story, documenting the story, perhaps bringing to the attention of the masses a number of individuals who've gone about their own business in their own way and established a new organisation or made a real impression on a single community? Well, a group of stitchers in the southeast of Scotland came up with an idea. After a project to produce a tapestry which documented the Battle of Preston Pans, organisers then turned their attentions to the international stage, exploring the possibilities of creating a series of embroidered images telling the story of expatriated Scots. Word of their plans quickly spread, with social media becoming a vital vehicle in recruiting interested groups of stitchers and exchanging ideas for panels. Their plans were ambitious, as project director Gordon Preston-Grange explains.
We're only halfway there, because we've gone through the process of creating, and now we're in the process of sharing it, because the whole purpose of the exercise was not simply to produce a beautiful work of art. It was to actually share the history that's implicit in it with people around the world who helped create it as the first stop. But then back here in Scotland with the younger generation and everybody else who cares about the history of Scotland and why Scots emigrated and what they did when they got there.
What I find interesting is that the success in which you managed to gauge so much interest in the project from around the world, because you didn't want it simply to be stitchers based in Scotland, perhaps based in the south of the country, coming up with ideas and looking at an atlas and picking different countries and finding stories and creating the work themselves. It was very much the opposite. You were trying to engage with so many different communities around the world and get them involved right from the very beginning. That would be a difficult process.
Absolutely. Well, the process was less difficult than the concept. The concept, which we learnt by accident on the Battle of Preston Pans tapestry, was that the people whose stories were being told had to authenticate the stories. And in the case of the Battle of Preston Pans tapestry, we knew we had to go out around the whole of Scotland and even to France and to Rome to find out what the story, the people living in those communities actually believed was their story in their locality. Because there's so much myth surrounding it. We wanted to make sure if there was going to be a myth in relation to the way the story was told in our panels and in our text that went with it, it was one that the people in that community were content with and proud of. It was their story, not ours. There were many history books we could have gone to, and the same is true of the diaspora to a certain extent. But we really wanted, and we learned from the Battle of Preston Pans, that by doing that, it released enormous energy in those communities we went to ask them what their story was. The follow-up question was, what's the story? Would you like to stitch it? And they were all saying yes. 80 or 90% of the time they were saying, yes, we'd like to tell the story our way, and yes, we'd like to stitch it. So when Andrew and Gillian and Yvonne and I sat down debating, should we do another tapestry? The answer from Andrew and myself, and from all of us really, was that only if it could capture that magic that was present in the first one, which we discovered by accident, because we were seeking to authenticate the story, and we found this energy and dynamism flowing from people because it was their story they were telling. So we were determined that next time round, if there was to be another tapestry, it had to be one where that same energy was present. And lo and behold, it was. We went to our twin town in Barga, and went to our twin... You're sitting in the Lord Mayor's Bar, the Gothenburg Bar here. Went to Gothenburg, which was the foundation for our arts hub. And we said to them, would they do it? And they had the same response as we'd had with the Battle One. Yes, we'd love to. Yes, we'd love to research the story. Yes, we'd love to stitch our own panels. And we thought, we're on to a winner here. This is going to work.
Gordon and his team welcomed subject suggestions from communities from around the globe, and soon they became inundated with ideas from enthusiasts keen to champion their community's Scottish roots and identity. Edinburgh-born artist Andrew Crummie, who had previously worked on both the Preston Pans and Great Tapestry of Scotland projects, was once again commissioned to come up with the panel drawings based on the various suggestions. Andrew's drawings would then be traced onto the canvas to make an outline of the eventual tapestry panel. I met Andrew at his studio to find out more about his role in the project.
Well, the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry was very much about people saying, could we do a panel about this subject or whatever? So the two drawings you've got in front of us are the Selkirk Colonial Society and John McRae, and both of them were requests to, could we do a panel about these? So it was about engaging and working with the people who wanted to do that and who would then stitch it as well.
So in a lot of cases, you were getting as much information from the stitchers, from the local communities, to ensure that the images were accurate, any colours were accurate.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
That,
well, for instance, the Selkirk Colonial Society, I had almost a completely different design at the beginning, but because it went to the Selkirk Colonial Society Committee, and it went to various other people who were connected with it, getting it, so a lot of things had to be taken out because they wanted it a certain way. So through that process, you end up with the final image. So it is really much about working with communities and really trying to listen to what they want, how they want they themselves to be represented.
Now, you must be an incredibly patient man, given that with the Diaspora Tapestry, you're looking at at least 25 countries, 25 communities around the world, and many more now.
You're talking about 700 stitchers globally. And, you know, about 300 panels. But it's not just me. There was Yvonne Murphy and Gillian Hart, who were sort of the core team of this part of the operation. And it was about gathering that information, put it in front of me, then I would do a drawing and then send it out, and they'd either come back saying they either liked it or they didn't like it or whatever. And then just really responding to that, and then, or, you know, just adding things or whatever, really. But it isn't me sitting in a studio being the artist. It's about me working with a range of people within a timetable as well to get it out.
Are you amazed at the size of all three projects?
Absolutely,
but particularly
the
Diaspora one?
The Diaspora one is particularly, you do sort of walk round the 300 panels and you are sort of, gosh, this is so overwhelming, because the amount of information that's in that Diaspora tapestry is absolutely massive, you know, and there's lots of really small details in it, and there's lots of humour as well, but the amount of information and the sense of pride that all these different communities are expressing about their link with Scotland or how their family have travelled the world is a huge responsibility, you know. So it's about, it is a lot of information.
They cover such a broad range of subjects. They make relatively unknown people very famous all of a sudden and bring their names to attention.
I think that's really probably the main thing, is like, you know, with the Great Tapestry of Scotland, a lot of people, part of the reason why you get, has had over a quarter of a million people visiting it, is because a lot of people don't know Scottish history. You know, they don't know the majority of Scottish history. When I was at school, I'm sure the same with you, you were only taught about Bonnie Prince Charlie, Mary Queen of Scots, a bit of something else, but not really much beyond that. And so most people's knowledge of Scottish history is quite limited. So they come to an art exhibition and they see this history. Now, when you go to the diaspora, the knowledge goes even down even less. And as you so rightly say, there are lots of people who have got Scottish roots, who are famous all around the world, but they're not necessarily famous in Scotland. And it's really quite interesting. I mean, John McRae is a really good example of that in Flanders Field. You know, without, you know, few people realise that the poppy image comes from his poem, you know, and his parents were Scottish, and he was brought up in Guelph, you know. But the whole, when you see the poppy thing every year, it actually comes from this poem which was written by a person with Scottish blood in them.
They're very striking images, and it's a very interesting way of, as you say, conveying the history or a story of a community or a story of a country, the development of a nation and the influences the Scots have had on the nation.
It's huge. I mean, the other thing that people are really struck by is the beauty of the stitching. You know, I mean, they just think, I mean, I was walking around the other day and I just thought, gosh, these are so beautifully stitched, you know, and the people are just in awe. It just gives that sort of real, sort of takes it, Madron's, to another level, and just gives us the sumptuousness to it. And that's why people are just amazed how creative these stitchers are and how the different, all the variation you can do around it and everything. So you put that whole combination together, and I think that's why it's an attractive package, you know, history, stitching.
The first part of the project reached completion on the 31st of March 2015, when the final panels were submitted to project organisers in the coastal town of Kirkenzie in the southeast of Scotland. Within 6 weeks, the tapestry had set off on its 18-month-long tour of the globe. However, for historian and project member Aaron Johnston, work doesn't simply stop after the tapestry returns from its world tour. He's keen to learn more about the many hundreds of stitchers and their relationship with Scotland.
My involvement started back with the Battle of Prestonpans tapestry. I'm a historian, and so I was working on that project and started organising its exhibitions afterwards, and then came on board with this project because it was very similar in terms of what it was trying to do as a community project, getting people to engage with heritage very directly. And so that was the sort of angle that I came at it. And of course, unlike that project, this doesn't need a historian sat in Scotland telling you what the stories are. This was a call to everybody all over the world. So what do you want to tell us? And that's really been the exciting thing about it, is that it's all, the content has all been driven by people out there in the diaspora. A lot of these stories are not things that we would ever have considered knowing about or creating into a tapestry like this without their input. So from my position, I did two panels myself, but you know, very small scale, not personal stories about my family, but things that I was interested in historically. But to see, as we've been developing the tapestry, is that we're really seeing that this has an awful lot of meaning to people directly in the communities that it's now visiting, because what you're doing is you're putting very, very personal, small stories, local stories, into a much, much broader context, and you can really see the whole network of Scotland's diaspora unravelling.
It's maybe important just to remind listeners at this stage that, of course, many of the panels were stitched, were embroidered in Scotland, but so many others were also projects that were carried out by groups overseas.
That's right. Awful lot of the stitch work was done overseas, the vast majority of it. And those pieces that were done in Scotland were primarily done by people with connections to the stories that they were stitching as well. So whatever way you were approaching it, most people had some sort of connection through their town, through their family, to their experiences with the stories that they were connecting to. And that gives a very strong sense of ownership between those who worked on the project, not just to the tapestry, but also to the heritage that the tapestry is representing.
And it's also a case of looking through the book and talking to many of the stitchers that the people that are working on these individual panels are identifying either a single person or groups of people who at other times in other textbooks would never necessarily be recognised for their contribution to an area. So that they're bringing to the public's consciousness a lot of Scots, of people with Scottish connections who have maybe done wonderful things, made a real name for themselves, but don't appear anywhere else in the documents and annals of history.
Yeah, that's right, and it's providing, and this is where the tapestry is so important, is that it's providing a platform for some of those stories to be told. And some of them are very well known locally on the ground in Canada or Australia or Zimbabwe, wherever it might be, but don't have an audience beyond that until now. And that story is being told right across Scotland, right across the world now. But it's not just people who've made specific large impacts in the community. It's not just big names or politicians or industrialists or whatever. It's also, there's a lot of content in there that is very direct about individuals and individual families that may not have changed the world, but they had their story and their personal experience of what it was like to bring your family across the entire world to the other side of the world and transplant your culture and your values and what you've learned through your own culture into a completely alien landscape.
Now, much of your work is still to be done. You've been very much at the heart of this right from day one. But you'll be particularly interested then to watch its progression, its progress around the globe and the response from people around the globe, I'd imagine, just to this. Because, again, we talk about the unique element. This is an arts project, a historical project all in one, but presented in a slightly unusual way and a very refreshing way, I suppose, for a lot of people to take in and absorb history.
Yes, absolutely. And really, you know, like I've said, if you're working with Caledonian societies in America or whatever, you might be very familiar with those connections, but you might have no idea what the Scottish connections to Ethiopia or to Antarctica or any of these other places are. So watching people everywhere it goes, learning something about how they fit into a bigger picture is very exciting. My big challenge now, as it evolves, is trying to actually get to the root of actually who all these thousands of people are all around the world that have been connected into this project. Because more often than not, what we have here is one or two named individuals that we've worked through. But when the lists come back, when we say, give us the names of everyone who's stitched on your panel, some of them are sending about 20, 30, 40 names. So who are those people, and how has this project drawn them in? And so what we're doing now is trying to get connected to all of those and ask them, well, tell us, were you connected to Scotland before? How much has this project changed the way that you perceive your connection? And that's really quite exciting.
According to the 2011 Canadian Census, over 15% of the population claimed full or partial descent from Scots. The proportion may be even higher, and so the impact of Scotland on the nation of Canada is certainly considerable. Scottish people have a long history in Canada, dating back several centuries. Many towns, lakes, rivers and mountain ranges have been named in honour of Scottish explorers and traders, such as Mackenzie Bay, while Calgary takes its name from a tiny village situated on the island of Mull. It's no surprise, then, that Canada features prominently, with 37 panels stitched or influenced by Canadians. The British Columbia panels depict explorer Simon Fraser, Governor Sir James Douglas, Vancouver Island coal baron Robert Dunsmuir, and educator and Arctic explorer Agnes Dean Cameron, the first female principal in Victoria. Jenny Bruce's tour guide while the tapestry is on display at Christchurch Cathedral in Victoria. What a place to host such an exhibition in its first visit to Canada.
It's just absolutely amazing cathedral. And the beauty of it, it's a side chapel up above the main part of the cathedral, main nave. But you can see it if you're sitting in the church, and you can see the exhibition with the amazing stained glass window in the background. So it kind of like almost echoes, because the design has got a kind of like a stained glass effect too. So you've got this kind of strange mixture happening in a most beautiful place. And of course, often there's people on the playing. Or singing happening. It can be beautiful. It's a really lovely, venue. It had its difficulties because there is a kind of fire access across the main part of this chapel, and I at no cost could I actually put the exhibition vertical. I had to sort of plan it so that it would fit into this particular site, but it's worked.
And judging by the reaction, again, from a lot of people coming from various parts of, Vancouver Island, not just Victoria itself, maybe some coming from the mainland already over to see it. We touched on this already. They're just blown away by it.
Well, in actual fact, we've got people coming from Australia. We've had them from USA, had Chinese people coming from USA who just came to see the cathedral, and they wandered into the exhibition, and honestly, their comments, if I can just give me one, just 2 seconds, and I'll read out their comments from the visitor's book yesterday, and it was, "We are so glad that we visited the first exhibition in Canada. It is wonderful enrichment during our visit from the US.
I mean, that really does tell its own story. I guess so many people would be so pleasantly surprised to see something like this, you know, and yes. As you say, that the first installment of this very long and interesting journey the panels will take, they'll dip into the uh-huh. United States, but there's at least half a dozen venues for the exhibition before the tail end of the year and before it begins to make its journey back to the UK and London for January 2017.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
The panels as well, there's a few that are of particular significance to British Columbia and to Victoria.
Yes. There are four that have been done by the Victoria Embroiderers Guild. And then there's another one which has been done by the bishop's wife. And the bishop actually is from Glasgow, this lady has translated this one. It's The Maple Leaf Forever. It's a story of John Alexander Macdonald, who was Canada's first Prime Minister.
So again, a real rich piece of history just in that one tapestry
yes.
panel. And one of the threads through the theme of the programme is just this refreshingly different way of bringing history to the attention of so many members of the public who perhaps have read textbooks, have obviously been to history classes when they were a student or when they were at school, but would never ever have had perhaps the opportunity in the past to learn about people like the people and the communities that you're exposed to when you walk around the exhibition.
Exactly. It's quite a remarkable feeling that, you know, that people come back out of it and they said, you know, I'm proud to be Scots. You know, there's this kind of great empathy with what they can see in front of them.
And
realise that, you know, the resilience, the courage that was there for people who went out there. But there's also the back side of all of that is the philanthropy and how those Scots, when they had made a really good life for themselves, they then gave it back by building, by creating all the buildings or setting up institutions, universities, whatever. There's that great part of it as well, which is part of the Scots character. You know, the old story of Scots being mean? No.
The Canadian panels are worthy of an exhibition all of their own. The range of subjects covered and the stories they tell are both hugely varied and fascinating. Sheila Collins, born in Aurora, Ontario, and now living in Scotland, dedicated a panel to John McCrae's poem In Flanders Fields. The panel was completed just 6 weeks prior to the poem's 100th anniversary. McCrae and the poem have both received many accolades in recent times, but Bev Diestricht, curator of the John McCrae House Museum in Guelph, is especially pleased to see him remembered through the work of Sheila and her fellow stitchers.
For sure, it will give him more recognition than what he has and in a different sort of medium than what is typical for John McCrae. So to be done with embroidery and to be included in this historic happenings with all these embroideries and these panels is quite incredible.
And of course, Sheila herself is now living in Scotland. Her father was a Scot. With John, it's almost the reverse because, you know, you look at his immediate family, those that were born in Scotland before leaving to settle for a new life in Canada. So, you know, Sheila's almost doing the opposite to what John did. But it's interesting that the two are tied together this way.
Definitely. I like that she included Thomas McCrae and Jean Campbell, who are John McCrae's grandparents, and they're the ones that arrived from Scotland to Guelph in 1849. Now, John's father was with them at that time, but he was only a little four-year-old boy. So the story really does start with Thomas and Jean coming to Canada, and of course, then I guess you can say the rest is history.
It's an alternative way, I suppose, to learn about John's story and his contribution.
For sure, exactly, and again, commemorating that 100th anniversary of the writing of the poem. And I should tell you too, Stuart, that the Guelph Embroiderers Guild here in Guelph actually have done a panel for this, and they focused on John Galt, who of course is the founder of Guelph. So it's kind of nice that we've got these two panels involved in this project.
Another panel designed by Sheila Collins tells the story of the creation of the Selkirk Colonial Society, established in 1910 in Hespeler, Ontario. The society was founded by exiles from the Scottish Borders town. The prime objective was to provide a flag, a golden banner, and send it back to their hometown. This flag would become a powerful symbol and rallying point for Selkirk's exiles who returned each year in June from all parts of the world to attend the town's famous Selkirk Common Rite. The Colonial Society's current chairman is Ian Clapperton.
The idea of the overseas visitors reception is to try to get the exiles to talk about their lives abroad and what it means to come back, meeting up with old friends and looking at over the town. For them, the highlight of the week is the Wednesday night and getting to revisit the town, rekindle friendships and getting into the spirit of the common riding.
And almost exactly the same time that these events were taking place, the Diaspora Tapestry project was making its way on the first leg of its journey. It would be in Veer in the Netherlands at the time. And as you've spoken about in the past, the pride of yourself, the Colonial Society in the town, to have a Selkirk Colonial Society panel representing the wider community and the full aspect of the Colonial Society within the 305 panels that make up this diaspora tapestry. So people around the world now are beginning to learn through the image and the text that goes with it a bit about this unique grouping of people and this annual celebration.
Yeah, we're delighted to have taken part in the diaspora tapestry. For Selkirk Colonial Society, we've had over 100 years of how shall we say, homecoming events. The Scottish Government introduced by their way of it homecoming events a few years ago, but the reality is Selkirk Colonial Society, and probably other societies in Scotland as well, have been holding these events for over 100 years. And we feel that it's nice to have an organisation like Selkirk Colonial Society where people from Selkirk who live abroad or who are descended from people who live abroad have something that they can connect to each year and throughout the year through the websites or the Facebook page, and in so doing keeping alive their links with their hometown. I guess the whole idea of the Colonial Society came out of the blue, if you like. I don't think anybody had thought about it much in the, up until 1910. But then the reality kicked in. We realised there was more and more people had emigrated, more and more people wanted to maintain their links with the hometown. And it was actually tremendous that the guys in Canada kicked the whole thing off.
Before the tapestry embarked on its world tour, Sheila and her fellow stitchers were given a sneak preview.
So, what do you think of it? Seeing it, yeah. It's a larger exhibition than I anticipated because there's just a wee small bit here mm-hmm. when I was up before.
So would I.
But there's lots here. Now it's going to be going all around the world.
All around the world, yeah.
I came in not really knowing what I was going to see. Came up the stairs and just went, wow. Because I didn't think that would see panels that I saw. And then when I went in looking at them, I just think that it's absolutely amazing the work that everyone's done. Just everyone was so different in its own way. Some beautiful stitching. Different kinds of stitching, the variety was lovely, the colours were beautiful, just all the different things, and I was really amazed at how, not that I'm being biased in any way, but the way that I was turned out, because well, just to see it like that beside the rest hanging, was just lovely. But so whatever, kind of, to pick one to say that I liked the best. I couldn't, because everyone had something good about it. And it was just well worth the trip here to see it. And I hope that everybody all around the world gets as much excitement and enjoyment out of what I have today, so, you know.
So what part of the Selkirk Colonial panel did you actually stitch, and how long did it take you?
Oh, heck. I stitched quite a bit on the panel myself, but I think it was just the passion. I just kept going because I wanted to get it done, and hopefully thinking time wasn't with us and if other people didn't have enough time. So I just got sat down. It just got a hold of me and I kept doing it. And I suppose I really stitched it like small stitches because I didn't want any of the cloth and the barking showing. And it has worked out well, because that's exactly what's happened, as did all the other stitchers. Everybody that worked on the panel did remarkably well.
With its Grampian Mountains and Water of Leith and cities called Hamilton and Dunedin, it's not hard to spot the legacy of Scottish settlers in modern New Zealand. The first Scots to visit New Zealand arrived with Captain Cook, and it's thought that as many as 20% of the first wave of European settlers came from Scotland. Many settled on the South Island. And Dunedin was home to the full tapestry exhibition, complete with its 11 panels dedicated to New Zealand, when the tapestry arrived in Otago back in April of 2016. It was housed for 3 weeks in the Otago Settlers Museum. And the museum's Kirsten Glengarry worked alongside tapestry on-site guide Jenny Bruce while the panels were on display in Dunedin.
I had an email from our former deputy mayor, Dame Elizabeth Hannon, and she had, I think, been strangely at a funeral in Auckland. It was somewhere like that, and someone had mentioned to her about this amazing project, the Scottish Diaspora. And you'll be aware, I'm sure, Dunedin has very strong Scottish roots, and she, whoever she was speaking to, thought it would be a great fit for us. And once she emailed and explained, it did sound like a really good option for us. And in the end, of course, we ended up being the only New Zealand venue. So we had people coming from quite far afield to visit Scottish Diaspora, which was wonderful. I have my great-grandparents are buried in Dunedin in Port Chalmers, and they came in the 1890s. And then on my grandmother's side, she's a Duncan. Well, she was a Duncan, and they came very early, I think about 1839, on the Bengal Merchant, which is one of the first ships into Wellington. So, yes, I've got, I know my Scottish forebears and when they arrived, and we celebrate. I think we're very proud of that background.
The exhibition, it still remains at 305 panels. Now, for you as a curator, that must be quite an undertaking. I understand the museum, the Otago Museum, is a sizeable venue, but even so, it would be quite time-consuming to assemble it all. I think the exhibition actually arrived a little bit earlier than you were maybe expecting, but that time would be valuable to line everything up and have everything organised for the first showing.
Well, at Toitū Otago Settlers Museum, which is the museum that we're at, of course it's a perfect fit, but we have a wonderful exhibition designer. So we did take quite a bit of time to plan so that we knew exactly where things were going to be going. And we had a wonderful person who was accompanying the exhibition, Jenny Bruce. She was fabulous. And there was a team of us who worked together to install and actually to take down the exhibition at the end. But we were wonderfully lucky to have a couple of volunteers who were involved in stitching the panels too for the New Zealand section. One came from Australia, and another came from Central Otago, and a few local people too. So we were really fortunate with the energy that came along with the tapestry or the diaspora itself. People that were involved in our local guild of embroiderers, they came and sat with the exhibition every day too, working on a project that they're doing, probably inspired by something like the diaspora. It's called the New Zealand Story and Stitch, and they work. In fact, it was such a good experience. They come in every week for a couple of hours and work away in our foyer. People come and talk to them and are inspired. So it's been a wonderful experience for us to have that exhibition.
And the overall
reaction response then from visitors? I would imagine it would be hugely positive, but were a lot of people just surprised by the scale of the project and what they could draw from each and every panel?
Yes, look, we had such great feedback from it, but I think you're absolutely right. The sort of realisation of all those countries that have the Scottish links. We'd been aware of an Indian connection here in Dunedin with the Kalimpong project that we'd been involved with that was through the Presbyterian Church, and some Indian Scottish, there was a connection there, which was wonderful. So when we saw those panels, and our curators hadn't been aware of that story either. So there were stories that from all over the world that I think that was one of the main things was I suppose you can just see the scale of Scottish influence in the world.
As a craft, it seems to be quite popular, certainly in Scotland just now, and that influence has clearly, been important in New Zealand because of some of the people that you mentioned and the association you just mentioned there.
Yes, that's right, I think. And it's good to see those skills and talents continuing in the world we live in now, which has gone so digital. It's great to see that handwork. I think it's got lots of pluses for telling stories, but just for well-being, just working like that. It's a good thing, a good way to be spending time, I think.
Writer and broadcaster Billy Kay has studied the extraordinary influence that Scots have had on communities and cultures on almost every continent. His book, The Scottish World, includes many examples of Scots who've been pioneers, leaders in their field, or simply played a hugely important role in enhancing the lives of people and communities around the globe. The tapestry contains many of these stories, and when we met at his home on the outskirts of Dundee, he was keen to stress the importance of their inclusion.
In a way, it was the older migration that interested me initially because it was an underground event. It was almost as if it was a secret history. So I find the chapters on places like Poland and Russia and Prussia and Scandinavia absolutely fascinating. And they were the ones that got me hooked on the subject. My background is that I started travelling when I was 15. I hitchhiked in France and Germany when I was 15. I went to Russia when I was 16 because I did Russian at Kilmarnock Academy. And then I started to get interested in American culture. I hitchhiked across America, etc., etc. So I did a lot of travelling on my own, off my own bat. And everywhere you go, you're profoundly aware of a Scottish connection, a Scottish influence. But then when I got the opportunity to work in the media, I was fascinated by this and convinced the BBC to let me do programmes on the subject. So a lot of the chapters in the book are based on material I collected.
By the 18th century, Scotland was probably at the forefront of Europe in terms of educating people and enjoyed a reputation of being one of the continent's most literate societies. Billy believes this undoubtedly aided Scots when they moved overseas in search of employment.
To be literate in the 16th and 17th, and even through until the 18th centuries, to be literate was like having a computer today. I mean, it just gave you such an advantage, being able to read and write, and being able to write things down. It meant that, there's so many areas of life where that was the case. For example, one of the reasons why the Scots were such brilliant plant collectors and gardeners and employed all over Europe as gardeners was they had the work ethic of the working class background, But they had the education that they could read the Latin names of the plants and study them and be able to have a written knowledge in, of them as well. And that was just such a unique thing.
The Scottish Government has been a supporter of the project from an early stage. Culture Minister Fiona Hislop was one of the first to see some of the early completed panels and visited the exhibition when it was on display in Paris.
It is the biggest community arts project in the world when you have 33 different countries and communities actually making this. Yes, they're telling the story of Scots that have travelled to the five continents and influenced the shape and history of those parts of the world. But I think what's amazing is that it's actually mobilised all these people in different parts of the world to actually make it. So we have stitchers that are connected to Scotland in some shape or form. So as an art form, I think it's really important. And it is about people, and people are always interested in people.
I know that you got to see some of the very early panels when they were completed, the Scandinavian, particularly the Swedish panels. That, I guess, would give you a flavour of what was to come. But I think perhaps yourself, like many of us, are surprised that 305 panels now exist and there's so many more stories to tell. It's been a real undertaking transporting this project around the world so far.
Well, in terms of the start of the project, you know, I was very much taken by this as being a really good way of celebrating the year of homecoming, because it's the stories of Scots travelling abroad, but also some of the panels are about Scots that have made their lives here but have come from other countries in the past. The Swedish panels are the first that I saw. Obviously the connections there were very interesting. I think the bringing of football I thought was one of the interesting ones in the panel. But also the Gothenburgs and the Goths, and you know, I'm from West Lothian. We still have a Goth in Armidale. You know, it's a leaning tower, a bit like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but if you want to come to Armidale, we've got a Goth. But those connections are really important because Scots have always travelled for different reasons, but also in terms of their impact, a huge impact across the globe. And we still have that impact. And I was delighted to be in France, and we launched and the exhibition in France. But what was interesting was to meet the community there, that you know, second generation French people who have Scottish connections, who were hugely honoured to be part of this and to tell some of the stories. Now, some of them we know. I'm from Linlithgow, so Mary Queen of Scots was born in Linlithgow Palace. Mary de Guise has her anniversary this year in terms of her birth, her impact. But I hadn't realised that Elsie Ingalls, that she's also been honoured because of her work in nursing in the First World War, very important in this time of commemorations. But what I wasn't aware of was James Young Simpson. James Young Simpson had an impact in France and was honoured by France. And in terms of his role, I mean, he was involved in some of the anaesthetics, and so those of us have given birth and to children, in fact, a lot, I suppose, in the development of medicine. So some of those connections, it was a Scot that helped develop the Banque Générale and invented banknotes. So I think there were slight problems with, you know, I think he was perhaps chased out of France at one point. So some of these stories are quite hard as well. And so to every country has its own history told in the panels, as well as a Scottish impact, but it doesn't shirk from some of the hard issues around the, you know, the slave trade, or indeed some of the exploitation that happened as part of empire. So it's a very real history of the world and reflects that impact. And Scots have reached all places. And you know, you learn. The panel helps you teach. And it's a lovely way of learning history. Not everybody wants to read books. But if you have the panel and you have the guide with you, you can focus on that. I think it's something that I think will... it's a great testament to the people who had the initial idea. But I just love the idea. It's the biggest community arts project in the world, that's involving the world, telling the story of the world, but through a Scottish prism.
Meeting the people responsible for some of the panels, as you did in Paris, you would, I'm sure, immediately be aware of the enthusiasm. You would feed off their own enthusiasm and their pride in completing these panels, because, as you say, it's been a community-based project. Nobody's had to sit a test or reach a certain standard in stitching before being allowed to contribute. They've all, you know, come from various walks of life, various standards of stitching, but had one thing in common. They wanted to try and make their mark, identify individuals who perhaps would never feature in textbooks, and say, you know, that these people are part of our community. They've
Scottish connections, here is their story. And as you mentioned in your last answer there, it's a very visual way of telling the story.
Yeah, and people engage with it, and the variation is obviously the style has been established, but the different quality and the different colours and the different interpretation as an art form is beautiful, and some of them are quite breathtaking. But only this morning I read a letter from Professor Wend, who's the principal at Queen Margaret University, and she'd been asked, because she was going to Barga in Italy, would she talk to the mayor about involving Barga? Obviously the Italian connection with Scotland is fantastic. And so she went and she asked the mayor if she could help mobilise and bring people together to make the Barga panels, which they did, and she was telling them that she'd been over and she'd helped launch it there. So not only is it reflecting past connections with Scotland, I think what's lovely is also managed to help develop current and existing connections with people in Scotland. And it's a great sort of goodwill gesture, I think, to the world as well. It's a gift for everybody. Now, we've funded it. The Scottish Government has put a considerable amount of funds into the project. £102,000 is a considerable amount of money. But I knew from the start that this would be a project that would have legs, and it certainly has.
The very fact it is reaching cities all across the globe, there seems to be a great deal of pride in each of the cities being able to host an event. They have a venue, an arena big enough to host such an event, because when you think of the size of 305 panels, it takes some putting on, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's some challenges in having venues that can have all of the panels and how they're shown. In Paris, it was right through the building. It was a community building. Interestingly, it was the company that owns the transport transport company in France, and they actually have their own community arts location that has festivals, music, etc. So it was right through the building, upstairs, downstairs, everywhere, and around every corner there was something interesting. So it'll be shown in different places for different reasons. And the hosts, I think, are, when they realise what it is, realise how it can capture people's imagination. And I was very taken by one of the stories. I didn't know that there was a Thomas Tate from Scotland who designed, interesting, St Andrew's House, the government house here in Edinburgh. He also designed the four pylons on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. He was a modernist architect of his time, and again, that's a story that I didn't know. The pylons apparently are there for artistic reasons as opposed to structural reasons, but Thomas Tate is a Scot who's obviously made an impact on what must be one of the most photographed bridges in the world. So that's a story that I didn't know. So I think what's great is the art of discovery, and you know, it's a reflection of Scotland that perhaps we don't know our own history as well as we could or should, so therefore the tapestry is helping tell us our own story as well.
After it completes its tour of North America in early December, the tapestry will then return to the UK in time to start a new year. Already the impression it has made on the many visitors across the three continents has been considerable. This window into the life of so many Scots and communities influenced by Scots has left a lasting impression.
My name is Jennifer Dunlop, and I was working on the Israel panels, right? And we did two. One was Israel in general, of all the different things that happened in Israel over the past 100 years or so. And the other one was particularly Tabitha School, which celebrated 150 years anniversary 2 years ago. Brought a lot of people together that each of us had heard of each other, but hadn't always met face to face. So it brought people to communicate about their experiences and their life in Israel, Palestine over many, many years.
It's pretty overwhelming. Mm. Yeah.
I just didn't think I could see all this. I don't know what magic and what thought.
The last time I was here, it was just a handful over here, and right. Now it's just loads of them. And the colours are just amazing.
I feel really honoured. I was delighted to be involved with the tapestry. The poem Flanders Fields is one that I have always loved. I love hearing every year at the remembrance services. and I was just really honoured to be involved with the panel.
For more information on the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry, including exhibition venues and dates, go to www.scottishdiasporatapestry.org.
Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of premier local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.